for this course, whatever, is as follows. We're going to eventually be doing contemporary halacha. But I do, whenever I learn halacha, I do it a bit differently than some other people do. And I think that you can't really understand halacha at all if you don't understand halachic process. I know you have a little bit of halachic process for those of you who go to Ray Rosenzweig's shir. Have you had that yet?
Yeah.
You've had that? Okay. So I don't know exactly what he does, and hopefully I won't overlap too much. But we will quickly get to contemporary halacha. But before we do that, I need to sort of explain how I see the halachic process and how contemporary halacha presents unique challenges to that. I'm just pretending like I'll split it up and put it over there. My artwork isn't great, but hopefully this is this will be clear enough. So a quick overview of what psak is. Okay? Yeah.
I'll give that to you soon, in a minute.
Okay, so let's first do an overview of what psak is, and then highlight the unique challenges of contemporary halacha, and then we'll split up and examine three models of how to approach psak in classic sources, just to sort of ground the ideas that we're going to talk about in the abstract now. So if I asked you, what is psak? Right, how does a posek, how does someone making a halachic decision, how does he or she come to a halachic decision? What do you do? You can use that graphic or not, but first tell me what you think. Right? How does one generate a psak? What factors go in to a halachic decision? And tell me your name as we go through.
I'm Naomi.
Where are you from?
I'm from Los Angeles.
Okay, what school?
Shahadat.
Oh, nice. Very nice. David Block and I were roommates in YU. We're high school friends. Good times. Good times. Yeah. Okay.
You need tax, resident, and expenses.
Okay. So let's analyze this. Okay. What do you mean by text?
Like either from like Torah, like an original source.
Okay. Good. Right. Original source. Right. So factor one is, well, let's be a little bit formal here. Let's call it canonical sources, right? Meaning sources that are considered primary because they made it into the canon of fundamental Jewish texts, right? Now, what do we do with this, right? We analyze these, right? So analysis, really, of canonical sources, right? This is important, meaning, or in maybe less formal or less highfalutin, primary sources, right? Now, what's the primary in the sense that these are the sources that everyone is in trying to interpret, to which you must explain yourself, right? This is the barometer of a legitimate psak, is something that can justify itself based on canonical sources, right? I mean, things that have made it into the canon, things that are primary, okay? That's one part of psak, okay? What else? I heard consensus. What does that mean? Consensus of who?
That there's like a community that's ready to uphold psak.
Okay, so here we actually have, right? Let's even break this down more, right? Community. What do we mean by community? Who are we talking about? There are two radically different things we could be talking about. No. We'll get to that. That's a subsection of what I want. Ashkenaz Sephard billets. Before we get to that, community, who's going to uphold? Who do you mean? What? Okay, but even more broadly, who do we mean? When you say community, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean? Who? Community of what? What? Jewish community, but who? In the community, there are two. For our purposes, there are two very important parts to this community. Yeah?
Like people who regularly keep halacha.
Okay, so one is, right, the practitioners of halacha, right, or the laity, right? The other is the poskim, the authorities, right? Those are not the same, right? Those are not the same at all, right? So factor two of psak is, let's say, right, precedent, right, which is previous authority. This is all on the sheet, but we'll get to it. Okay? And the last one, right, let's call it, for the moment, custom, right? Because when we're talking about, now by custom, I don't mean like, as opposed to halacha, I mean simply what people do, right?
Right.
Custom is in what, the lady, right? Right, the hamon am, the people who actually keep halacha, do. Right? These are, I think, the three basic factors that any posek will take into account when they're trying to generate, let's call it, the most plausible psak. Okay, the Ramban makes a point at the introduction, Jumlachamot Hashem, that law is not math. Right, math works on, right, absolutes. Law works on plausibility. Right, plausibility. What is the most likely? Right, not the only possible, but the most likely. Again, you don't even have to write this down. Right, I would encourage you not. For here, I went as you know, I was as detailed as I could in making this graphic. Okay, right? Yeah.
Can I get a copy of
this? Oh, did.
I don't think there were enough, and I like.
Wait, they told me 16, so that means there are not enough. Okay, can what?
I'm dealing with it.
Okay, is there? There's a copy machine, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you want to just make a few copies? I'll try.
Sure.
What?
Sure. I'll come and make copies.
Okay. Thanks. I don't know who said that, but whoever said that, thanks. Thank you. How many more do we need?
I need one.
I need one.
No, we need one more. Oh, there's one extra over there.
There's an extra. Wow.
Do we need more?
No.
Need more?
Yeah. Okay, so.
We don't?
Thank you so much, though.
Okay. 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 So, I think any posek, any authority, has to take into account, fundamentally, these three factors. Their own analysis of canonical sources, right? The text to which we are all beholden, what previous interpreters of the tradition have said, right? Precedent, and what do people do? Right, how has halacha been practiced? When poskim take these three factors and they mix them all together, they get, as I said, the most plausible psak. Here's the problem. Okay? This is, I think, a pretty good summary of very broad strokes what a posek does. Except every single one of these issues is fraught with 1,000 problems. Problem one. Two is that how much weight to give to each of these factors is not clear. Okay? Are we clear about the two types of problems? Right? One is that these are the factors. But how much weight you give each of these factors is not determined. Right? The fact that every posek cares what it says in the canonical sources, and I'm being vague on purpose. We will get clarity in 2 minutes, or more unclarity, but whatever. We'll be clear about what we're unclear about. They have to care what the canonical sources say. They have to take into account how that tradition has been interpreted by the recognized bearers of that tradition. And they have to care about how halacha has been practiced. But how much weight they give to each of those is not determined. And different poskim will give different weights, different amounts of weight to each of these factors. Okay? That's only half the problem. The other problem is analyzing any of these is very, very, very complicated. So, let's start with this. Analysis of canonical text, primary sources. Okay? So now I ask you, good, what goes in there? Right? We agree, right? Everyone agrees that part of making halachic decision is figuring out what do the central texts of Jewish law say, or Jewish normative sources. Okay? Law, and we'll include within that moral discourse and everything that's normative, meaning anything that dictates practice. Okay? How many problems do we have right here? Right? Name some problems that come up. Even figuring out, not just, obviously, analyzing the text is hard, but before we even get to the text, right? Yeah.
What text?
Yeah, what text? Good, right? Figuring out what text is not an easy question. Give me a text that is obviously in. I can think of one, right? Maybe. Yeah.
The Torah.
So that's an interesting question, right? Is that, yes, the Torah is in, but what's the problem? Right? This is an interesting problem. The Torah, as in the Chumash, is in. But, is it really in?
Gemara.
Oh, good. Okay. So, the Bavli is clearly in, right? The Gemara is in, right? But, for an individual posek, is the Torah in?
If you're Karaite.
If you're Karaite, it's in, because this doesn't matter. Chazal don't matter. Yeah. Right? But what's the problem? Yeah.
Names.
Dalia.
Why would the Gemara, the Bavli, be in if the Torah isn't in, when the Gemara often quotes the Torah?
Oh, good. So the Torah is clearly in the sense that the Gemara itself understands itself as bound, correctly so, to the Torah. Right? But what I want to describe is not, at the moment, how the entire process. I want to understand the process a posek goes through in making decision now, post-Talmud. Right? Now, there's a difference between saying the following. Everyone will agree with the following statement, which is, we are beholden, right? A canonical text for the purpose of practical psak is, how did the Bavli understand the Torah? Right? Meaning the Torah is clearly in the equation. But here's a question that's not so clear, which is, what if I read the Torah without the Bavli? Right, now, I'm not going to do Karaite now, right? Karaites will say we're not bound by Chazal. Even if you assume you're bound by Chazal, what if I interpret the Torah in a way which does not contradict the Bavli, but was never discussed by the Bavli? Can I, in 2019, generate a new halachic category based on my independent analysis of the Psukim? Yes or no?
No.
And that is why I said, understanding this question is not easy, because this is a machlokes, right? There are poskim who will say, absolutely not, under no circumstances, the only possible thing that can bind you is how Chazal, in the Bavli, understood the Torah, and if you have your own interpretation of Chumash, even if it doesn't go against Chazal, right? We're not talking about contradicting. Even if it doesn't go against, it's just not discussed by Chazal, too bad. So the question of practically, is the Torah an open source for Psak is actually not clear. It's, right, obviously, the Torah is important, but for practical purposes, is it something that a posek will look at? That's not clear. What else makes, what type of questions make this complicated? That's one, right? That just highlights how complex this is. I saw a hand up over there, and you put your hand down. Okay, so we'll, right, even within the Bavli, right, is who in the Bavli? Fine. Now, that may go to precedent, maybe, but fine. Million other questions. What else? Here. A big one in Israel. What's the authority of the Yerushalmi? Right, or the Tosefta, or the Sifrei, or the Zifra? All other sources of Chazal besides the Bavli. Machloket. Is Kabbalah a primary source?
No.
What?
No.
I hear no's.
Famous source.
Good. So I hear no's. I hear no's. But, again, for the moment, I don't want to make a decision. I want to highlight why this is complex. Right? Many poskim will say, absolutely not. Right? No. Kabbalah is not a source, or at least, well, let's be careful. In what sense is Kabbalah not a source? There are two ways it could be a source. One is, as a canonical, right? One question is, are the texts of Kabbalah canonical?
No.
Let's say the Zohar. Second question, I don't want an answer yet, I want questions, right? Second is, even if it's not canonical, what might it be?
Precedent.
It might be important in terms of precedent, right? Now, do you understand how big of a question it is to say, right, there are three questions, right? Which is, do we care about Kabbalah at all in Psak? Yes or no? Okay. Even if you say yes, Is let's say, the Zohar a canonical source, in which case later authorities must interpret halacha in light of this source, which gives it a lot of weight? Or do you say, well, it has weight, but only insofar as it clarifies, let's say, the Bavli, right? Those are two very different positions, right? Right? Does it matter at all? Is it canonical? Or even if it's not canonical, does it matter as precedent? Right? Again, I'm not answering questions yet, but I want to highlight why, even if I set up these three factors in Psak, each one of them is subject to a million sub-questions. What else?
Midrash.
Good. Midrash. Agadah, right? Which texts in the Bavli? Right? Even within the Bavli. Right? What about agadic material? Right? Is there a difference between agadic material in the Bavli and Midrash? Right? Another question. Good. What else?
Where are we saying that canonical ends? Like, would you heard?
Good.
Good.
Very good. Right? Which is, who gets to be up here and who is merely here? Right? Chronologically. Right? We could draw the line at the Bavli. We could draw it at the Rambam. We could draw it at Shulchan Aruch if we wanted. Right? The difference psychologically, or procedurally, really, right, between those two questions is, right, if you think that Shulchan Aruch is a precedent, right, maybe even an important precedent, then that means that in order to paskin legitimately by Shulchan Aruch, you need to understand how you got from Bavli to Shulchan Aruch. If you move the Shulchan Aruch into canon for all intents and purposes, what does that mean? That I no longer care, right? I take on authority Rabbi Yosef Karo's right to interpret the Bavli, and now I try to interpret Rabbi Yosef Karo, right? That would be a huge move, right? A dangerous move, right? Probably a move that people wouldn't make, though, admittedly, the Chasam Sofer, right? The Chadam Sofer in many places sort of sounds like that, right? Not quite, but he definitely moves it, let's say here, somewhere in the middle. Yeah?
Hey, this is just kind of nitpicky about the language that we're using, but doesn't the word canonical imply that there's like no doubt about what's inside it?
So I'm going to use it here not for something which no doubt, but something which is treated by the Posek as unassailable in its authority, meaning something by which I must justify, right? It's in the primary texts that I now view not as secondary interpreters of a previous authoritative text, right? If you want, we can say authoritative, okay? Absolutely authoritative, okay? Right? Authoritative. I don't care, right? Canon, authority, right? But absolute authority, right? Not like authority in this sense, right? Absolute authority, okay? Now, we could get into other ones, but let's suffice with that for now. Precedent. Great. Everyone agrees that we have to care what previous poskim said. Okay. We all agree with that. We have to care. That was very vague on purpose. Now, this is ambiguous. Why? Yeah.
What defines authority?
Good. Who? Who gets to count? What else? Yeah.
How much do we like, care about it?
Yeah, how much do we care? Right? And then, questions like? Rove. Right? If different authorities say different things, how do you get, right? What's the role of majority versus, to use the language of the Gemara, Rov versus Mumche. Who do we care more about? Numbers or expertise? Right? What if you have 75 second grade poskim and 3 Gedolei Ador? What do? Right? This happens, by the way. This is not like theoretical, right? This was, as one of my friends once explained to me, this was, do we have any British students? Okay. So this was the, as it was described to me once, the machloket in London over the Eruv, which was the majority of major rabbis in London didn't like the Eruv, except for rabbi number one, right? What? Well, not Rabbi Sachs, but the posek of his bezdin, which was Dayan Aronchoy, who was like the heavy hitter among poskim, right? He was the head of the chief rabbi's bezdin. Still, I think he's emeritus now. He's emeritus now, right? This is a problem, right? What do? Right? Now, even within this, great, we like majority. How do you define majority? Yeah?
Well, there's like majority and then there's plurality, which is like majority is Everyone's so
ambiguous. Okay, good. Good. Majority versus plurality. Good. That's going to be one ambiguity. What else? Yeah.
You could say, like, majority of people in general of, like, or you could do, like, majority of a specific group of people, like,
good.
Halakha followers or just, like, men.
Good.
Like,
what else? What else? Good. Who? Right? The majority of the Jewish people, majority of authorities, majority of people keep halakha. What else? How about current majority or majority over time? That's a big difference. And how about if you get a majority, but only because there's one major posek who has a lot of students? Do they count as one person because they're really themselves only relying on another authority? Or does each of their authorities, right, do each of them count? Right, do you understand how many problems there are, even if I say I care about precedent, defining precedent? Who counts as precedent? Do I care about majority? Do I care about expertise? How do I define expertise over time in one generation? All these things are problems. Okay? Custom. Clearly part of it. Part of it. Custom of who? Jews? Halacha keepers? Right? My community? My country? My ethnic identity within Judaism, right? Ashkenaz, Sfarad, does that even mean anything? Is that a meaningful statement at all? Because it was not until, like, for the most part, until, like, 75 years ago. For the most part, right? Because what did it mean to be Ashkenazi? To live in a certain place, right? At some point, geography became replaced with ethnicity, and it's not really clear how that move happened, right? Right? That's a huge problem in modern Pesach, okay? Do we care about the halacha, the custom of the uneducated? Or is it only the experts? Only the educated laity? Right? Do we write off the customs of the non-educated? Now, custom. Do we mean customs that are non-halachic? In the sense that no one claims they come from halacha? They're binding only insofar as they are a custom? Example, Kabbalat Shabbat. I don't know if it's binding, but nobody thinks that that's a halacha. Everyone understands we do it as a custom. But we do it and it's meaningful because it's a custom. Then there's customs like Svardim follow the Beit Yosef in Pesach. That's a custom, right? People are accustomed to follow a halachic position. But that's not a custom which is binding because of custom. That's a custom which the claim is the custom binds you to a legal position. Right? So I hope in just 20 minutes I've convinced you that even if you accept my basic claim that Pesach fundamentally is a sum of how do you analyze absolute authoritative text, canonical text, primary text, call it what you want, plus what have previous poskim said, plus what do people actually do, each of these has sub-questions which make answering these major questions, right? These level one questions, really hard. Again, what counts as a primary text? Bavli, Yerushalmi, Tanakh without the interpretation of Chazal, Kabbalah, Agadah, Agadah within the Bavli, Agadah outside the Bavli, etc. Precedent. Who counts, right? How many people? Expertise versus numbers. Numbers of who over time? In one generation, students versus teachers, etc. Custom. What customs? Things that are merely custom. Custom which reflect a halachic position. Customs of a place. Customs of a community. Customs of a nationality. Etc. 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 Yeah.
Shouldn't the system, like, isn't the original intention of Judaism not to have a system like this at all? Because everything you were talking about, mainly in, like, authoritative or canonical sources, were the written down Torah Sheba'al Peh, which was always meant to be spoken so that you couldn't create rigid laws that, like, didn't have exceptions or leniencies in certain situations.
Good. So let us add a layer of complexity. I'm going to primarily talk about this year, the real versus the ideal, right? The real, not the ideal, right? But you're right that part of this question is going to be, is any of this, right? This is my descriptive rather than prescriptive. assessment of what poskim actually do. But you're right that there is a question even sort of prior to this, which is this ideal, meaning is this what halacha wanted, right, which is a system of unclarity, or did it want a system in which there was only, let's say, straight tradition from Sinai, there was a Sanhedrin Haggadah that easily resolved every single question, right? Meaning, there is a prior question to this, which is, even if this is a fair description of what poskim do post-Talmud, how did we get here and why did we get here? Now, for most poskim, I think, even if that's an interesting question, it's not a live question, in the sense that doesn't animate their everyday psak. But that's only partially true, right? Because you will see poskim every so often who will say things like, to give an example, Reshechter, and I think we might analyze this position. The laws of kashrut. Right? The laws of kashrut. Pots, pans, things like that. Right? The number one practical rule, I don't mean like halakhic rules we're talking about, but the rule that creates most of the problems that we deal with is what's called ta'am, right? Taste. Right? We know you can't have not kosher food, you can't have milk and meat, but when people call you with questions, they don't usually ask, can I eat pig or can I eat milk and meat? The answer is no. What they usually ask is, I dropped my spoon in the wrong sink, in the wrong pot, in the wrong whatever. Did it create problems? And the question then we ask is, was there transference of taste? And practically, how do we deal with transference of taste? The questions we need to ask are, how many hours since it was last used? Right? Was it clean? What food were you using? Things like that. The problem is that all the halachot in the Gemara are based on a reality in which they were using pots that are slightly different than ours. They weren't stainless steel, let's put it that way. Okay? How much taste is absorbed into the walls of a stainless steel pot? I would say none, but let's say an amount that is so vanishingly small as to be insignificant. Okay, let's cover all our bases. Okay? What does that do to the laws of kashrut? So, yeah, what does it do? Oh. So what does it do? What are our options? Yeah.
Well, we didn't exercise the option of, ignoring it.
Good. One possibility is, who cares, right? There's a principle the Gemara laid out. It applied in one way in their pots, and now we just know it's wrong. So erase everything and start again, right? Which, I think we will analyze this position this year. This has not 100%, but this has 90% been what Rav Malamud has decided to do, and has been working on for the last few years, and will publish in full form in Panini Halacha sometime this year. So as soon as it comes out, right, I have the previous versions, but he keeps promising he's coming out with it. But that's basically how he understands this. Right? Rav Schechter says, well, I think as soon as we get a Sanhedrin back, that's what we're going to do. But I am stuck because of procedure. Right? Now, there is a middle position, which is to say, I'm stuck because of procedure, so I can't throw the halacha out, but I will apply every leniency in the book because I know this is only a technicality and not substantive. Right? That's a bit of a compromise, but something you'll actually see. Right? Or for another example, again, from Rav Schechter. Right? This is where Rav Schechter actually does what I just said. Right? Bishul Akum. What is Bishul Akum? Food cooked by non-Jews, right? What is the purpose of that halacha? Probably. To, let's say, prevent intermarriage, though that's a bit more complicated than that, but let's say that, right? Meaning, prevent intermarriage, meaning prevent problematic interactions between non-Jews, which could lead to many things up to and including intermarriage, okay? Industrial kashrut. What's the problem, conceptually?
Lots of non-Jews,
but there's no interaction. Good. So now we have three options. We can apply the laws of Bishul Akum regardless of the fact that the reason doesn't apply. We can ignore the laws of Bishul Akum by saying the reason doesn't apply, or what Rav Schechter actually says, which is, just to give you an example of where this might come up, Rav Schechter says, we can't break the law because it's formalized. But it's legitimate to look for every possible legal loophole because the procedure has frozen us in essentially a meaningless law. So we're stuck, right? In an ideal world, we would uproot it, but we don't live in an ideal world. But we do recognize the role, let me just finish the sentence. We recognize the role that the ideal plays in how we think about things and makes it legitimate ethically, let's say, religiously, with no, ethically is the wrong word. It makes it a legitimate act of halachic integrity to look for formal loopholes, which doesn't technically break the system and also doesn't run afoul of the spirit of the law, because the spirit of law, the law is dead anyways. Right? Because, right, it wasn't created for industrial kashrut. So usually the question of ideal versus real isn't a live question. But sometimes it is. Yes. We'll just go around this way, it'll make it easier. I'm sorry.
So morality is less important than procedure.
So this is not morality. Okay, good. Okay. Hold that thought. 2 minutes. Okay? Hold it. It's very important. We're getting there. Yeah.
So, what if it's like unclear what the actual, or even if it's, no, what if it's unclear the reasoning behind an actual halacha, then like, how do you deal with that? And also when it is clear, like if the Talmud explicitly states like, this is the reason for this halacha, then are you able to...
Oh, good. So that is a subsequent, that is a very important question within Psak, which is, right, are laws reducible to their reasons, such that if their reasons no longer apply, does the law apply? And second, how would you even figure out the reason in a absolute sense, right? Both of those questions are very important, right? And they go under, well, they go over here. But we're going to have to, again, today, by the way, if you walk out frustrated, then I've done my job, right? I'm not trying to give you any clarity right now. I'm trying to explain, right, the complexity that we're about to walk into this year. Okay, yeah.
Well, I just want to confirm what you just said. So you said, like, in terms of that case, we wouldn't really, the law that was, like, before about the pots and pans, because, like, it was applying to different pots and pans, it's considered dead, and that way...
All right, well, so most poskim don't agree with that, right? Okay. No. So we'll see. Rav Malamud really sort of does think that. Not 100%. But mostly does think that,
okay.
Right? And therefore, he has started to say, yeah, if you accidentally, right, drop your spoon, you stir your meat pot with a dairy spoon, right? He has said on paper, right, this is not, right, this much he's already clear about.
Yes.
You don't have to ask 24 hours anything. The answer is kosher, period, end of story. All those halachot, not applicable, right? Yes, that's what he said. Do most people agree? No. Will they agree in 2 years? Maybe. In 10 years? Not implausibly. Right? The effect of printing something in a book and being a well-respected posek, that plus time works magic. So I can't tell you that in 10 years that won't be what the average rabbi tells you. I'll tell you nowadays that's not yet what the average rabbi will tell you. Even rabbis will say that should be what they tell you. They might not tell you that. Yes?
The way that I was brought up, like, when my mother would hear about these kinds of things, she'd get so annoyed. She'd be like, we're stuck in meaningless laws. And we're stuck in laws now. Just like you said, like frozen in laws that we can't get out of, that were there for no reason.
Yep. I didn't say it wasn't frustrating.
Why? Like, how could we possibly think that this is the Judaism that we were buying into?
Oh, it's very simple. It actually is simple. It doesn't make it better, but it's actually pretty simple. The answer, I think, in a nutshell, is that halacha is law, and law is by definition and by design conservative, right? Small c, in the sense that it is reluctant to change because it protects the totality of the system. Every legal system has bureaucracy because, right, and things move slowly because that leads to the best overall, you hope, the overall life. Because, right, when we all recognize, right, let me just give you an example, okay, a very simple example, right, and actually let me add one point to that. And every legal system has laws that apply whether or not the reason applies. Okay, let me give a simple example, okay? If I ask you, I don't think there'll be any dispute about this. Why does one not run red lights? Why is that illegal to run red lights?
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous. Good. 3 o'clock in the morning, nobody's on the road, right? You look both ways, right? There's really nobody on the road, and there really isn't. Not like someone's rushing. There really isn't anybody on the road, and you run a red light, and the camera sees you, and you go to court because you got a ticket, and you go to the judge, and you say, Well, everybody knows that the reason that you don't run red lights is for safety, but it was totally safe. No one was on the road. What will the judge say to you? Too bad. And then if I turn to you and say, but why? This is a frozen, arbitrary law. What will the judge say?
It's law.
It's law. And why does that make sense? Why does that make sense? Wait. Why does it make sense?
Because you need people to, like, follow law.
Why?
Because then, like, there would just be chaos.
Oh, good. So one is simply chaos, but here I want to, here's what, the point I want to highlight. Is the reason, is the judge saying that this law is arbitrary? No. Is the judge denying your analysis of the rationale for the law? No. Why is it illegal to run the red light anyways? Correct, because you can't have everybody make that decision, because at 3 o'clock in the morning there might be no one on the road, but someone might make that same decision, right, when someone is rushing around the corner. So my point simply is, right, again, each of these questions you have to, right, I'm not saying this is the end of the discussion, but I just want to highlight the fact that law by design, right, is not reducible to its rationales. Because if it were reducible to its rationales, right, it would generate chaos, right?
I understand that. I love law. But that's one of my favorite things about law, is those kinds of examples, is that it exists even in the premise of when it doesn't make sense, because it's a classical manifestation that exists beyond its grid. I love that. I love that about law. Anyways, but my thing is, and I know slow change. I know that. Like, that's my mantra in life. But is that all it is? Is that the only reason that halakha is taking over our lives?
Oh, that's not what I said. I didn't say that's why halakha is taking our lives. I said that's why certain laws, right, continue to be, right,
in frozen halakha are taking over our lives.
That is why certain frozen halakha take outsized roles in our lives. That's probably true. Right? Yes. I'm willing to put my name behind the fact that certain laws, admittedly, are frozen, right? And they become very important. Now, I don't think it's as many as you think. Right? I don't think it's as many as you think. I think it is certain frustrating ones. Right? Meaning, I happen to find the kashrus one frustrating, because that's actually a law which affects a lot. And that's why I think Rav Melamed is, right, it has started to actually, you know, sort of bite the bullet and say, no, you know what? This is not one of those laws, right? And that is definitely on my list of topics to cover this year, right, is that one, because I think that highlights the problem, right? That type of case. Certain ones, I don't think anybody cares, right? Certain ones, I just don't think anybody cares. I don't think you realize, right? But there aren't so many. Right? At the end of the day, there are some. But you have to expect in a huge legal system, right, there's going to be some, right? That shouldn't surprise anybody. Right? There are vestigial laws. That makes sense. Right? Okay, we're going to go around. You had a question? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just about the whole, I don't know if I'm being too specific, but about the whole Austin, like, you don't know that everyone's using the steel pots.
Correct.
You could be using, like, cast iron skillets. And then...
Good, and therefore there will be... And
you make a blanket law that says...
Good, and part of it might just be because you can't distinguish. You're right, and that will be part of it. Right? And you're right. You're 100% right. It can't, right? Because you have two possibilities. You could say, this applies to stainless steel, or you could say, it's too dangerous for me to make those distinctions. I'm going to act as if all pots are the same. Those are two options that POSKIM have in front of them. Right? But I just want you to understand that those are options. Those are choices. Right? Okay, you had your hand up for a while.
Yeah. Like, going back to our example of, like, not eating, like, a food that non-Jewish people cook because it would lead to intermarriage.
Yeah.
But isn't there also an idea that, like, the reason is that you don't eat it, so you don't eat puzzle food
So I was hoping no one brought that up. So technically, you're right, right? Technically, it is a machloket. Rashi on Avodah Zarah Lamed Hey and Avodah Zarah Lamed Chet says both of those different things. I was assuming the majority view, which is about intermarriage. You are correct. There is a secondary tradition in the Rishonim, which was... has one day in Rashi, but is championed by the Rashbam, that the issue is that you're worried that not kosher food will be mixed in. And one of the ways that the Tzitz Eliezer made industrial kashrut relevant was that he brought that second strain of Rishonic thought back into the modern discussion. And that is a perfect example of the types of things that sometimes happen in modern psak, which is voices that have been less dominant, but now suddenly are more relevant than the voices that used to be dominant, come back into conversation. And that is the type of thing you'll find in modern psak. That was excellent. but I tried to get away from it, but I can't. That's fine. That's fine. But yes.
How do you respond to that?
Oh, so you either say, well, that was not the dominant voice for a reason, or you say, as Cicely Ezer says, we only legitimate leniency if you can solve both problems, meaning there's both, you know, let's say strict government oversight, and it's industrial, then it's legitimate to employ kulas because we've knocked off both rationales, right? Again, you still can't eliminate the halacha, but it's legitimate to be lenient. But that's exactly what Tzitzili Ezer says. No one should be afraid to push me on something because sometimes I will oversimplify things, but I will then recomplicate them if you push me on it, okay? Anyone on this side that didn't get a chance, otherwise I'll go back and let people do seconds. Yeah. Okay. Wait, you didn't ask a question yet. Okay. Yeah.
So something just like specific example of the whole coffee issue. My dad was telling me about an issue where certain like factories still have their chicken stock in like a very stainless steel metal tubes, whatever, and they'll be transferred across the country. They'll get there, hyaluronically press clean it. Everything's ridiculously molecular to the molecular level clean.
Yep.
And still kosher wise,
yep.
You can't transport
them. And that highlights the problem. Yep. To put it this way, as one of my teachers once said, the way that we allow using things like that is we clean it with usually like a gas of ammonia or something like that, because that will, in halacha, right, be pogame the taste, right? It'll make the taste. But as he said, if we really believed that in reality it had the ability to go into the pot and destroy the taste, we would also die, right? Because, right, there's an irony, because the way we'll kosher it is by using, let's say, something which is poisonous, right? But we'll use the pot right afterwards because we don't really believe the poison went into the walls, because otherwise we would die, right? And yet, right, we're stuck in this irony, because for halachic purposes, we'll kosher it with something which destroys the taste, but we know that neither the first taste nor the second taste went in because it's both clean and not poisonous. That highlights the problem in a perfect way. You are 100% right. And that is exactly why Avraham Alamut wrote what he wrote. And again, that's why I'm going to use this example. Maybe it'll be the first one. I don't know. I haven't decided. Yeah.
So the example you gave of like red lights in America.
Yes.
In like the American government, basically.
There are red lights here, even if.
Yeah, but like that's like.
Even if people ignore traffic laws here, they do exist.
Yeah. That law is still, like, the reasoning for it still applies sometime, but, like, most
of the time. Oh, for sure.
There's a lot of laws where the reasoning for it would never apply.
Good. How do you get rid of those laws?
Yeah. And we do not have...
How do you get rid of them in American law?
In American law, you have the Congress, which will...
Correct.
Which can overrule, or the Supreme Court can rule them unconstitutional. You have a multitude of ways of getting rid of those laws, which is my question. We don't have that bureaucracy, even if the bureaucracy is...
Correct, and that's where we get to the ideal versus the real. You're right, we're stuck. Certain things we're stuck. Yes, certain things you're right. We need, in fact, we have a language for that in the Gemara, right? It's Ein Beit Din, right? Rashai Levadel Beit Din Lechavero Atche Yegadol Mimenu Bechachma Uveminyan, right? A court cannot overrule a previous court unless it's greater in number and wisdom, whatever that means, right? And we don't have a Sanhedrin, therefore we can't do it. And yet, sometimes we do it. Right, sometimes we do it anyways, and the question of how we square the rule on the books to the fact that sometimes we get rid of it is, I would say, a topic that deserves a dissertation, but really it's a topic that just got a dissertation, which I haven't yet read because it hasn't been published, but I'm waiting for it, right? And you can ask him when he comes, he's coming, right? Shlomo Brody, the guy who represents Tikva, who's going to come and talk to you about Tikva at some point, right? Over there, the picture on the wall, right? The Tikva organization, right? He runs the Tikva... the Shana Baharit program, that was his PhD, which he finished and submitted. You can ask him. He's the world expert on it. You can ask him, which is why I told him as soon as it's published, I want to read it, and maybe I'll have more insight. But in the meantime, I'm as confused as everybody else. Okay. We have not yet finished our grand tour of Psak. We've only started. Okay. Now we've highlighted the complexity of all this. There are still two steps we have to do to get to a psak. Again, I'm on here. Okay, let's go start with a normal case. Normal, regular, run-of-the-mill case, right? What do? We have all of this. We have now generated the most plausible psak, right? Not a psak we're 100% convinced of, but a plausible psak. Now what do we need to do? Apply it. Thank you. How easy is applying it? It is a nightmare and a half, right? You think it's easy to apply, but that's actually a very hard question, both practically and conceptually. And I gave you here just an example of this. So, first of all, it's just hard to determine reality. Second of all, here's a meta question for you. Who gets to determine reality? The posek or the expert in their field or the individual, right? This is a big issue in medical psak, right? In medical psak, it's very easy. Everyone knows, if someone's life is in danger on Shabbat, what do you do? Violate Shabbat. If someone is going to die on Yom Kippur if they don't eat, what do you do? Great. Now, here's the question for you. Who gets to determine whether someone's going to die on Shabbat if they don't do something? What? The doctor. Good. Which doctor?
The one at the hospital.
So, here are possibilities. The one who happens to be there. The one the patient chooses. The one the rabbi chooses to ask his question to. A panel of three doctors that the rabbi turns to, and majority of three. By the way, that's actually a major posek that I know. That is how he determines it. He asks three doctors and takes Rov. Right? Because Rov... Do you understand how... We can all agree that the doctor should be deciding it. The problem is, figuring out which doctor is not just a technical problem, it's a meta problem. Right? Right? Because you could, let me just highlight your options. Your options are, whatever doctor's there, or the job of a posek is to determine reality if he isn't a doctor, so he figures out the reality however he sees fit, or the job of the posek is to provide theoretical psak and leave it to the patient to figure out how they want to maneuver the reality. Those are very different practical ways. So even this question of, here we have a psak, and now we got to go to application, is fraught with meta-halachic questions. Yeah?
But in that situation, since pikuach nefesh is deraita, wouldn't you always like
good.
Be more lenient?
Good,
like,
good. So you'd say, well, pikuach nefesh is easy. Good. Let me throw out some that are even harder. Right? This is easy. This is easy. This is nice. Right? Let's get a bigger one. Land for peace. Everyone, even if you agree that it is legitimate to give up land for peace because it'll save lives. Right? Who gets to determine whether it will be pikuach nefesh to give up land or it'll be pikuach nefesh to keep land? The rabbi? The general? The general that the rabbi asks, the consensus of generals, the politicians, a vote, a referendum, the people whose lives are in danger, who gets to make that decision?
And who chooses
whether they give the land? Yeah.
Which
land? Sure, there are 100 options we can think of. My point is that application sounds easy. Except, even if every posek in the world managed to agree on what the theoretical psak can be, suddenly things can explode when you get to application. Because application is, or, why do I do this to myself? To make things controversial on the first day if they weren't controversial enough. Why am I about to do this to myself? Poskim, who say that we would allow certain practices that seem feminist if we believed that the people doing it were doing it for the right reasons, but we don't because we think they're doing it for the wrong reasons. Does a posek have the right to judge other people's motivations?
Yes.
Oh, see, we have... Look at that! Even within this group, even when I've made it clear what the consequences of what I just said are... Right, I got a yes and a no. I'm so happy. Right, I'm so happy. I got a yes and a no. Right? Let's say a posek says, I would allow a certain thing, but I don't because of policy, because I think that the women doing it are doing it for pernicious reasons. Right? They're trying to undermine halacha. That posek is not making a halachic statement. They're making an assessment of reality statement. Do they have the right to make assumptions about people's motivations? Right? You can all, I'm sure you all know how often that argument is drawn and how there, the question isn't a theoretical one, it's a application one, and shocker, it is controversial. Okay? I'm not putting my name behind either side. Please don't kill me. Okay? I'm just telling you, okay? So, Now I've convinced you that even application is hard. Now, that's a normal case. Now, just to throw in the last prong, let's make it even worse. Okay? This is all true, as I said. I was very careful. All of this gets you to the most plausible psak. Do we always paskin like the most plausible psak? We don't. When don't we paskin like the most plausible psak?
Extenuating circumstances.
And, right? We are allowed to rely on minority positions or less plausible positions, let's say, in extenuating circumstances. And now you open a can of worms, because now the question is, what counts as extenuating circumstances? And you've probably heard some of these. Things like Chil Hashem, Kavod HaBriot, Kavod HaAdam, Hefsed Merubah, right, monetary loss, Yuhara, which is religious hubris and arrogance. Religious Zionist postkin, right? Will this allow the society to function, right? I don't know. Will it cause non-religious Jews to hate Judaism? Is it making people hate Judaism, right? All those are extenuating circumstances. Now, because remember I started and said that halacha doesn't, right? This process only gets us to plausible, right? That's why this is an open, right, question, because think about it, right? If something was 100-0, how legitimate would it be to say, well, let's rely on the zero, the position that is obviously wrong? Not. But what if it's 55-45, right? I go through this whole process, and I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's this, but it could almost equally be the other one. So, if there was nothing pushing me, what would I do? 55. But how much pressure would it take for me to spin like the 45?
Not that much.
What if it's 80-20? What if it's 90-10? What if it's 70-30? And these are just right, theoretical. Or let's just summarize it in one sentence. The more unlikely a position is, the more pressure the posek has to feel to rely on the less plausible position. That doesn't mean they never will, because if the pressure is great enough,
you can get
to take it in a medical example, right? If you went into a procedure, God forbid, and they said the chances of surviving are 50-50, how many people would go in that procedure? Under normal circumstances, most people would not do that. What if the options were, but if you don't go into the procedure, you have a 95% chance of dying, right? But if you do the procedure, you have a 50-50. Suddenly, that's a chance I'm willing to take. Or even, you have a 75% chance of dying if you do the procedure, but 100% chance of dying if you don't. You go in. You understand how even things which are not, right, which are dangerous, if the counter pressure is worse, you will do it. Right? That is true in psak. So now, my summary of psak, right, in a nutshell, is this. First, the posek tries to figure out the most plausible psak in a vacuum, which is, when I balance, however I balance personally, the question of precedent plus independent analysis of the primary sources plus custom, I then come up with a psak that I think under normal, in a vacuum, is the most plausible, and if I have no other pressures, I will poskim like that. But if I have extenuating circumstances, whatever counts as extenuating circumstances, I may be justified in poskiming like the less plausible decision. And once I've gotten all of that, I then have to apply it to reality, which has its own nightmares. Great. Now one more thing before I then send you to sources, is this is psak in general. Why is contemporary psak even worse? Right? Why is contemporary halacha even more fraught than a theoretical halachic decision? Which of these factors gets more complicated? Yeah. Precedent. Good. In contemporary halacha, there often is little to no precedent. Right? So it complicates this factor. What else? There is not an established custom because it hasn't been around long enough, right? What else? It is not clear how the authoritative sources even talk about it because it's a new question which Chazal don't explicitly address. Great. Our three factors of psak have all now been called into question. Great. Now, what about application to reality? Does that become more complicated in modern circumstances?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right? So that's part four. And does the modern world introduce different types of extenuating circumstances?
Yeah.
100%. And now you understand why contemporary psak, right, I find fascinating. Because psak is complicated, and every single thing I knew about psak, right, when you deal with new questions, right, You have to re-examine every single factor because every single one of them is complicated by a host of new issues, right? Let's take, who wants to throw out an example and we'll do a thought experiment, right? Throw out a modern example and let's try, right? Not, we won't do this fully, but throw out a modern example and let's try, yeah.
Car is beeping at Jonas and it's really annoying and he's like disrupting all your neighbors and they're gonna come at you with like pitchforks.
Perfect. Electricity. Alright, any electricity question. Great. Problems.
Didn't say anything about electricity.
Good. The Gemara says nothing about electricity. Well, that means that we have no authoritative text directly to work on. Precedent.
No precedent in electricity.
So there's precedent, but it starts basically in the late 19th century and a consensus has never been reached, right? Well, that makes this complicated, and that's why in the last 5 years or so, 10 years maybe, Postkim have re-examined electricity. Custom? Also a bit interesting because it's not actually so clear, right? Maybe now the custom has emerged that people don't use electricity on Shabbos, but how new is that custom?
Pretty
darn new, because there are people in Europe who still thought it was permitted, at least on Yom Tov, if not Shabbos, right? But this one maybe not as complicated. How about applying it to reality? Good, but let's even make it more complicated. The Chazon Ish, let's said electricity was forbidden because you closed a circuit. That was true in the time of the Chazon Ish. When is that not true?
Now,
why not?
Because it can still work. Even if you
good, it's called continuous current. Who has a device with continuous current? Raise your hand. Anyone have an iPhone? Anyone have an iPad? Good, all of you. So even if we had had a consensus about the Chazon Ish, right? Fast forward 30, 40 years, we have continuous current, and guess what? We're no longer opening and closing circuits. Applying to reality suddenly gets more complicated. Yeah?
Our technology, like heart, what is it called? I forgot what it's called, the thing on the heart.
That yes, pacemakers and stuff like that.
And
yep,
like,
yep, and that's extenuating circumstances. Good, what if, my favorite case to open this up, right, is a little bit more comical than that one, was a case, there was a lawsuit several years ago in London of people who claimed that they were imprisoned by their landlord because the landlord told them he would not put the light sensors on Shabbos, and he did, so you couldn't walk out of your apartment on Shabbos because it would turn on the light, so they sued. They sued because they claimed they were being imprisoned by their landlord because of halacha. Is that a plausible halachic conclusion? Or if you want to be even more radical, right, or are you allowed to walk outside because Google, right, Google Maps has its cameras and they will find you and they will, right? This was driven home to me when I went on Google Maps once to get directions from my in-laws' house, and the picture that came up had my wife and I walking to my in-laws because that was when the camera happened to take its picture, right? It is watching you. Can I not walk outside now, right?
That's different.
What?
Triggering.
Oh, good. I don't want to come to conclusions, but I want to highlight how both the complexity of understanding the reality and the potential extenuating circumstances are complicated. So, why do I like contemporary halacha? Right? Because really, I like halachic process. I love halachic process. Right? But contemporary halacha takes everything I know about halachic process and adds 10 layers of complexity to every basic factor in Pesach and creates the nightmare that is...
You sound
right?
Frustrated.
No, not really. I really have fun with it. So here's my goal for the year, okay? Let me just... Now, with that hour introduction, right? My goal for this year is primarily to analyze contemporary halacha, because that's what I was asked to do, right? But with an eye towards methodology. I don't just want to understand local issues. I want you to walk out of this year, whoever stays in this course, right? Not just with an understanding of, let's say, 10 issues or 20 issues or 40 issues, but an understanding of how Poskim deal with the inherent complexities and ambiguities of questions that are not the same rehashed questions, that they are just transmitting, but how they deal with new questions. And I want to do that in two ways. One is to take certain sugyot, which have been dealt with by Poskim, and analyze what they're doing. The other is to take issues that have not yet been dealt with Poskim and work with you and figure out what would you say, because the Poskim haven't yet made up their minds. Okay? That's what I want to do. Right? Those are, I think, the two ways to understand contemporary halacha. Again, things that have actually been dealt with or are being dealt with by Poskim, analyze what they're doing, and taking issues that the Poskim will deal with presumably in the next few years, but haven't yet done it, and trying to figure out what you would do. Okay? Yeah.
If there's an issue like electricity or maybe like genetic engineering or something like that doesn't exist in the canon of like the Gemara, basically, why don't we just go look back at the Torah in that situation and try to extrapolate?
Well, you made an assumption there. Why don't we? The answer is some poskim really might, right? Some poskim might do that, right? They're more out of the box, they're eccentric, but Rabbi Elbanon actually does that. Rabbi Elbanon actually goes in that direction. He's very eccentric. But he does go in that direction and says, yeah, I think electricity is usher because of how I understand the Torah, the Chumash. Sure, that's what he does. Most people don't do that, but what they will do is say, okay, but I will be creative in how I understand the Gemara, right? Now, I will just point out, Which type of posek, who likes precedent or likes independent analysis, is going to have an easier time with contemporary psak? Yeah, right. Someone who is more analysis focused is going to have an easier time with new questions because they always try to understand the principle of the matter rather than looking at what previous people said. But poskim will care a lot about precedent. Less so, which is why it's not an accident that one of the most important poskim of the 20th century, hands down, is not actually a particularly important posek on radically new shailas, Reb Avadya Yosef. Right? Reb Avadya Yosef is a precedent posek. Right? He quotes and quotes and quotes and quotes. When it deals with very new shailas, he doesn't really have many tshuvot, and when he does, he ends up just surveying the little literature that exists in the 20th century. A posek like Moshe Feinstein, right, who is very, very, very much into his independent analysis, has a million groundbreaking tshuvot, right? Because certain types of poskim, depending on how you weigh these factors, is going to have more success dealing with shailas in right the contemporary period. That's just the name of the game. Yeah. How does one become a posek? Woo! Yay! Yay! How does one become a posek? Sit down for this one. How does one become a posek? Well, you tell me. How do you think? What? Nope.
You need people to follow you.
Okay, good. Part of it is people need to trust you, right? You can't be an authority without people who are going to listen to you. Perfect. Great.
Are there people who call themselves posek who, like, you wouldn't call a posek?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I will not put names to that, but yes. How does one become a posek? What do you think? What do you need to be a posek? Okay. Ooh, okay. Knowledge of halacha. What do you mean by that? What do you mean? No, I mean that. The ability to analyze, knowledge of precedent, understanding of custom, the ability to apply, right? And understand extenuating circumstances, right? Meaning, these five factors, if you can master all of these, then you can be a posek. How easy is it to master that? Not, yes. Not. That's the short answer to it. How you get there practically is learning a lot, watching either how poskim, paskin, or studying psak to understand how psak works. There's not much more to it. It sounds really easy, but it's maybe it doesn't, right? But that's the basic answer, right? There is, right? You definitely do not need to be a rabbi, right? Being a rabbi is neither a necessary nor a sufficient quality of a posek, right? There are many people with the title rabbi who either do not act as poskim or should not be acting as poskim, right? And there are plenty of people who do not have the title rabbi who I would trust asking halachic questions too.
Yeah. Ooh,
that's fun. Well, so if you ask them, they'll tell you no. Okay? If you ask them, they'll tell you no.
Because they have to? Or because they're like,
they want to distance themselves.
If you ask them, they'll tell you no. If you come to my house and ask my wife, she will tell you, no, I'm not a posek, I'm a yoetzet. That's what she'll tell you. is what they do psak? Maybe. Okay. Okay, here, let me tell you a story. Okay, here's a story. For reasons that I will not analyze, I will not get into at the moment, but let's assert this. They're asking halachic shayla does, in fact, bind you in a certain way. Why is a very interesting question, why the act of asking a shayla binds you to the answer you get. But for our purposes, there are basically two reasons why this might be true. Well, three reasons, okay? There are three reasons. One is because once you've asked someone, it is now either not respectful, which is what Rashi says, or to ask someone else, possibly one. Possibly two is, for metaphysical reasons, a posek is granted the ability to change your halachic reality. That sounds radical, but that's actually what the Ritva says. Possibly three is, by asking the shayla, you now bind yourself to that decision based on a type of a vow. Okay? Are those somewhat clear? So here was the question, okay? I asked, my wife and I, when we were first married, we asked a nida question to, my wife was not yet a yoetzet, we asked a yoetzet, okay? She gave an answer, okay? And I was in smicha at the time, I wasn't totally convinced that it was correct, right? And then I consulted with some, of my rebbeim, and they agreed with my analysis, okay? But here was the question I then posed to Rai Willig. And I said, listen, I went back to the, so under normal circumstances, I'm not allowed to do that, right? If I ask a shayla from a posek, I'm not allowed to then go ask somebody else. But the question was, in this case, the person I originally asked gave me an answer. I treated it like a shayla, right? But she didn't, because her party line was, I'm not giving you psak, right? Am I bound to the original answer, which was more machmir, because I treated it as a shayla, and I was expecting a psak, but she gave me an answer but didn't view it as a psak, right? Well, that's a fun question, right? It hangs on what I just said, doesn't it? Right? If the reason a psak is binding is because the person who asked it has now bound themselves to the conclusion it doesn't matter whether the person paskening calls it psak or not. But if it's about this magic word called psak, then it suddenly matters whether the person who gave you that decision thinks whether it was psak or not, right? This is a fun meta question. It was also fun having the Rai Willig, because Rai Willig and I have a wonderful relationship, but he knows, right? Like, Rai Willig isn't the world's biggest fan of Yoetzot, but he's also not the world's biggest critic, right? So he has many students who are much bigger fans of Yoetzot than he is, so it's fun having this conversation with him because, right, he's somewhere in between and he knows, right, that I'm a much bigger fan than he is, but he gave me, he said, by the way, his answer was, no, you're not bound, because what's important is how does the person giving the question, or giving the answer, approach the answer they're giving, not how you approached it, which he's right. That much I will buy, because we really reject that other possibility. So do Yoetz, are Yoetz out poskim? They will tell you not, right? Is where they're doing psak? Maybe, right? But I will also clarify another thing, which is that how much of the questions that you ask to a posek are, and the answers they give is considered psak? What percentage?
Not a lot.
Because the definition of psak, and I can't prove it to now, but maybe we'll get to it, right? The definition of a psak is something, according to Allah, is something that requires shikul hadat, meaning something that is not open and shut. If it's open and shut, that is not called a psak, that is called providing information. Right, those are not the same thing. Right, psak is making an independent decision that is not black and white. Anybody can provide information, posek or not. To paskin is to make a decision when the answer isn't clear.
Can Yoetzot Halachot do that?
And that's where I said, so 90% of the shaylas that come to Yoetzot, that's not an issue, because they're not of that type. Right?
That's why I'm asking.
That's why I'm hedging here, because the party line is they don't do that. Most Yoetzot I know have no interest in doing that, and they either ask their poskim or ask the posek of the person asking the question. Right? There are Yoetzot that I know right, who don't do that. Okay? There's one in particular I'm thinking of who, when my wife was talking to him, he said, right, most yoatzot, right, just the reality is, should not be making those big decisions by themselves. They should be consulting with whoever. Except, I won't say this on recording, right, except yoatzet X, who can do whatever she wants, right? Because she is, to this day, one of the scariest people I have ever met, right? And one of the smartest people I have ever met. And when she says halachic things, I listen, right? But that, by the way, that's not about yoatzot. 90% of rabbis are also not poskim, right? Nor do they view themselves as poskim, right? Most shilas that come to the average rabbi are open and shut, or they ask their own rabbi, right? Very few poskim view themselves as poskim in the sense that they are deciding decisions on questions that are not yet clear. Okay, I want to make this. This is not like a male. No, I'm just saying this is not a male female thing, right? At some point, I was complaining about certain women who were presenting themselves as poskim, and my critique was that these particular women, right, not about women, that I didn't feel like they had the qualifications to be doing that. And my wife was talking to a friend. She mentioned this critique, and she said, "Does Jonathan do the same thing to male rabbis?" And my wife, Aura, said, "Of course, he complains about it all the time. I am an equal opportunity critic of men, right? I am totally, right? I will tell you, right? I am, on these issues, I am equal opportunity. I both think that, in theory, right? I think that sex, gender, however you want to use that, right, is not an impediment, right? I think that, right, the number of people who are qualified to be actual poskim in the sense that I'm using it, right, making decisions on things that are unclear is very few, male or female. And if I think that someone has those qualifications, then I really don't care whether they're male or female, rabbi, not rabbi, I don't really care. I will ask my questions to them. That is my personal, right, that is my personal opinion. I want to make it clear, because someone will listen to this recording and yell at me. I am not weighing in on, like, female rabbis. I'm just not. I don't care. It makes no difference in my life. I'm talking about psak. I think women can poskim. Whether that means I think they can be rabbis, which is the controversial question, right? All those people in cyberspace, right? Right? I'm not weighing in on it. I just don't care right now. Okay? I just don't care. Do I think they can poskim? Yes, because the Sefer HaChinuch says they can. Right? Yeah.
I just have some practical questions. What's a shaila?
Posing a halachic question.
Okay, so if I'm asking like a theoretical question...
That is not a shaila. Good.
Okay.
That is clear in halacha. The Gemara tells that very explicitly. A halachic psak is a practical instruction in a specific case. Right? Ad sheyomrim lo halacha lemaaseh. Right? That's what the Gemara says in Horiyot Daf Bet, Bavabacha Kof Lamed. That is... Right, a theoretical question, right? This is important. A theoretical question is not a shaila. A shaila is, what do I do?
Is shaila the Yiddish word for shaila, or is it like...
It's the American yeshivish way of pronouncing the Hebrew word of shaila, correct.
Okay, then yes. I'm not saying that.
Okay, fine, shaila, that's fine. Yes, it is an American Yiddishism, presumably, yes, of the Hebrew, yes. If you want, I can call it a sheila, I can call it a halachic query, whatever you want, I don't care. So some people will go to a posek, and some people will go to their rabbi or whoever, who will then be their liaison to the posek, right? Some people like going straight to the posek, some people don't, right? Some people would, because poskim don't necessarily know you, right? You'd rather talk to your rabbi, your teacher, the person you trust, I don't care, right? And have them be a go-between, just because they can explain the circumstances in a way that the posek will understand, not being, you know, not knowing you personally. Yeah.
Right. Do Sephardim and Ashkenazim have, like, go to different poskim, or is it, like, the same?
Yes, they do. Whether they have to depends on whether you think that Ashkenaz versus Sfarad is still a meaningful category now, because it was, like, as I mentioned before, it was once a geographic statement, now it is an ideological or ethnic one, right?
Well, it, became an ethnic one because of the different customs and, like, ways people were following halakha.
Well, no, it really became... It became an ethnic one because people moved.
Okay.
Right, meaning people had different traditions, but they also lived in the same place. The notion of having a vibrant Ashkenazi and Sephardi community next to each other is a relatively modern phenomenon, right? And that is why it is a very complicated halakhic issue itself, which is, and also not every issue has to do with differences of Ashkenazi or Sephardi opinion, right? Some things do, obviously, right? But not everything, right? Many electricity, there's no divide. It's not Ashkenaz Sephardi, right? That developed post the Ashkenaz Sephardi divide, right? Okay, so that is my hour and a quarter summary of what is the basic contours of the halakhic process and why is contemporary halakha even more problematic than, let's say, well, I don't know, come up with something that has that is not contemporary. Good luck. But, yes?
Was Ali Grant's work?
No, it was, yeah, it was rhetorical. I mean, you can come up with them. There are some, obviously, right? I mean, look, as I said, even dropping your spoon, right, the classic, like, kasher shayla, but, I don't know, an avelos shayla, okay? Avelos really hasn't changed very much. Most of it. Some of it has, right? But, like, when do you tear kriya? Okay, fine, right? That has not really changed very much, right? Certain things in avelos obviously have changed, right? Like, but, yeah.
I mean, I know people do. Like, if I broke my arm, I would have my parents like...
Well, it depends, right? If there was no... Theoretically, if there was no Shaila of Pikoach Nefesh...
Then you can't die, but you're in so much pain.
So then, in theory, no, right? In practice, right, the question that's always going to complicate things is how do you know that there's no Pikoach Nefesh, right? That's always going to be the... Right? In theory, if you knew, the answer would be no.
Also, wait, but what if...
I said, if you knew, how often... Remember I said, applying to reality is one of the hardest problems here? Yes, I'm aware of all the things. Trust me, I know what can go wrong there, okay? Right? How many of you have parents who are doctors? Right? So you know how many things you can go wrong, or normally go wrong. My mother was an epidemiologist, until she retired, was an epidemiologist in the Department of Bioterrorism. I know things that can go wrong, right? And I've heard things that go wrong that, right, will never happen, right? Right? And yet my mother is paranoid about them. So, okay,
yeah, also,
true story, also, right? True story. My first week of yeshiva, I was on the phone with my mother. I sneezed, nothing more. And my mother said, Jonathan, now that you are immunocompromised, you are more likely to develop horrible diseases like staph infection. Do me a favor and don't die. This is literally how my mother views the world, so I know how many things can go wrong. Okay? Okay, I know. Like, my mother let me go to the yeshiva I went to in Israel, despite the fact that it's in the West Bank, because originally she was scared, and then she said, well, statistically speaking, you're more likely to die of a horrible disease here than from a terrorist attack there, so it doesn't really matter. Right? So, trust me. I know how many things can go wrong, okay? I know how many things can go wrong. I really do. Okay? I really do. My mother worked with the anthrax scares with the FBI. Really, I know what can go wrong. Okay? I really do.
You know, schools and Shabbat, like, almost every week growing up, of, like, people just coming to our house,
yeah,
because they knew my mom would keep Shabbat.
Yeah, so look, doctors get it all the time. Like I said, growing up, my house for several years was, you know, on the automatic, like, emergency hotline from the government when there was, like, you know, concern of, like, terrorists, like, bioterrorism in the city, right? Trust me, I'm paranoid enough. I know what can happen, okay?
My
what?
My mom is not enough paranoid about anything, but she's an ER doctor. She has to have no fear.
Right, yeah, so this is the opposite.
Yeah.
My mother is paranoid about everything, right?
No,
literally
no
everything. So yeah. Okay, so we now have 40 minutes. So here's what I want to do, okay? I did promise that I would do Seder, and most days I really will do more Seder than now. I really do want you to engage the text without me sort of reading them to you. So let's do a little bit of... Well, okay, we have 40 minutes, so we can do this different ways. I don't want to spend more than a week on what I'm about to give you. What I'm going to give you now is just the introduction to the Beit Yosef, right, Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Darkei Moshe, which is Moshe Israelis, right, meaning the two main authors of what we call Shulchan Aruch, meaning Shulchan Aruch and the comments of the Rama, their introduction to what they think Pesach is, and then a third one written contemporaneously by the Yom Shor Shlomo, by Shlomo Luria, explaining their halachic process, right? Because so far I've just described this outside. I want to prove to you right, just in very quickly, that what I'm saying is not totally insane, right? That in fact this is how Poskim think, right? And that not all Poskim weigh these three factors the same way. Okay? So you can tell me how you want to do this. We can break up for, let's say, 20, 25 minutes, and then the last 15 minutes I can summarize what they say outside, or because we only have like 35, 37 minutes today, we can sort of read it together, and in the future, right, we'll do more Seder plus Shir. However you want to do that is fine. I really do mean, I promised Dr. Goldstein this, that in general, right, we will divide. Right, in general, what we will be doing, like I said, we're mostly going to be doing contemporary halachic issues with an eye towards methodology, right? So what I will do on most days will either be give you a topic with a few key sources, right, and let's say one or two or three models of modern Poskim who dealt with it, right, and analyze what they're doing, not just what they say, but what they are doing. Or I will take a shaila that has not yet been really analyzed, throw some major sources at you and see how you act as Poskim and see what you come up with, right? That's what I will, right? Which is fun, right? Last year, with my students at Migdal, I had a few of them who came to my shir on Tuesday night. At some point, I had them write a tshuva. That was fun, right? I created a theoretical shaila. I gave them packets and packets worth of sources and said, go, act as a posek, see what you think, right? And then presented the whole yeshiva and defended. Good luck. Which was something I learned from Roy Clapper. And I did for 4 summers in his summer Beit Midrash. It's a fun experience. I don't know if we'll do that. But we'll, maybe. Maybe we'll do that. But in the meantime, we'll do sort of mini versions. But what do you guys want to do today? Right? Again, today, options are break up for 20, 25 minutes, try to skim through these sources and then summarize at the end, or just read these together because we only have 35 minutes. Do you care? You want to break up? Break up so that I can take a break from talking? Okay. 2 pages. Is there a stapler? If there's a stapler here.
I have a stapler.
Okay, so it's 2 pages. You can staple it as you wish. We are missing our stapler at Migdal. Just pass it around. They're collated, so just take 2. Divide that up. Make sure. Just make sure you have 2. Take to like a quarter 2 to try to skim it. It's a bit... it's not so short, but like these are just their introductions to their svarim, explaining their methodology. Try to get a feel for what they're really arguing about, and then we will reconvene at 1:45. In general, I'm going to try to make it about half-half. In general, it'll be about half-half. Probably not an hour, right? Probably what we'll do in general, which I found worked well in a program I ran over the summer, is 15-minute introduction, tell you what you're looking for, 45 minutes to an hour of chavrusa, and then reconvene, right? That's, I think, how we're going to do things, but we'll play it by ear as we go through the year, okay? Okay, fine. By popular demand. Oh, wait. Oh, do I not have for myself? That's fine. That's fine. Thank you. Okay, so just to prove my basic theses about psak, what I gave you, like I said, I'll give this back to you. Are the three? Is there a tour here? Is there a tour?
Oh,
the three.
We've been really into like the philosophy show. The Gemaras have mostly gone looked at nicely.
There's a tour.
I don't know.
There might be one. Okay. Anyways, it's fine. So basically, the text that I gave you are as follows. So the maybe basic text of halacha that most people know nowadays is the Shulchan Aruch. Right, Shulchan Aruch, however you want to pronounce that, I don't care. Written by Rabbi Yosef Karo in the 16th century, who lived where? Started there, lived most of his life in Tzfat. Right, in Tzfat. So he writes the Shulchan Aruch, as I said, is a summary. Right, what he really writes is, so there is a code that came before him, which is called the Tur, the Arba Turim, written by Rabbi Yaakov Bal HaTurim, the son of Rabbeinu Asher, known as the Rush. So Rabbi Yaakov Bar Asher, writing in Spain, though his father moved from Germany to Spain, so he sort of transversed that Ashkenazi-Sephardi divide, writes the Arba Turim. The Beit Yosef, Yosef Karo, writes an encyclopedic work which is framed not as a commentary as much as organized according to the Torah, in which he presents the basic positions in halacha as it emerges from the Gemara, summarizes for you the positions of the previous authorities, and then Paskin's halacha. At the same time, Reb Moshe Israelis, living in Krakow, is writing a commentary called the Darkei Moshe HaAroch, which is also a commentary on the Torah. He stops writing it when he finds out that Reb Yosef Karo is in the middle of it and has published it, and instead he truncates it, writes a summarized version, and only adds what the Beit Yosef, in his opinion, got wrong or left out in what becomes known as the Darkei Moshe HaKatzar, right? An abbreviated version of his commentary on certain books of the Torah. We still have the long version, and you see, it is basically an Ashkenazi version of the Beit Yosef. When Reb Yosef Karo writes his Shulchan Aruch, which is a very, very abbreviated version, it's just the bottom line psak, the Rama writes the Haggah, he writes a gloss on it with what he feels is the Ashkenazi tradition when it diverges from the position recorded by Reb Yosef Karo. Okay? About the same time, Rav Shlomo Luria, also in Poland, opposes the entire move towards codification, right? The whole notion of writing codes at all, he doesn't like. And he writes instead a halachic commentary on the Gemara known as the Yamshel Shlomo, in which he lambasts all those who are involved in codification. He doesn't like that entire methodology. And in the introduction to each of those three texts, these three major poskim introduce what they think halacha is. Okay? And I want to read with it just a little bit with you so that I convince you that what I said is not made up, right? This is not my prescriptive, right? These aren't prescriptive claims about halacha, like this is how halacha should work. These are my descriptive claims that having read a lot of halacha, this is what poskim are doing, right? I'm not making here a judgment call. This is what they do, right? Whether you find it compelling or not, right, in any given circumstance is a different question. But this is what they do, okay? I want to prove it simply. A good place to go is these poskim are all, at least two of them, right? Two of them. We'll get to the Yamshel Shlomo in a minute. But at least the first two are generally assumed to be the most important poskim in the last 500 years in the Sephardi and Ashkenazi traditions, whatever that means, right? Basically understood to be that, right? So this is simply descriptive, okay? First text I gave you is the Hakdamah to the Beit Yosef. So this is how Rabbi Yosef Karo describes what he is doing. And yes, I left in some of the poetry because I don't know when this happened, but poskim used to be much more poetic than they are, right? Their books are not just, right, informative, but they're fun to read. They loved poetry. They loved using poetry to thank God. They loved using poetry to insult people they disagreed with, right? They appreciated the aesthetics of writing, okay? And so I like put it in. So he starts off, Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael Shebara Olamo L'Tachlit HaAdam. Right? Thank God who created the world for the purpose of man. We call Min HaAdam Bachar Lo Am Skula. And amongst humankind, right, the humans were the purpose of the world. Amongst that, he chose a nation. Yaakov Chevel Nachlato. Right? They also were very into integrating psukim into their poetry. Yaakov, the Jews, are his portion. Umeirov Ahavato L'Am Krovo. Because of his love, he brought us to our Sinai. And then he gave us, right? He gave us through the greatest of human beings, through Moshe Rabbeinu, Alav Hashalom, right, of blessed memory, Torah, Mitzvot, Chukim, Mishpatim, Tzadikim, L'Tov Lanu, L'Man Eilech, B'Drachav, Nimtzmach, Ein Beinav. So we could follow the Torah and find favor in his eyes. V'yi, Ki Archu Lanu Hayamim. But as time got longer, right, as time passed, horaknu mikli al kli, we have been emptied from one vessel into another. Uvegola halachnu, we are in exile. Vekamat zarot zurot kufot v'zarot zulazu. We've had so many catastrophes, one after the other. Ba'aleinu ad kinitkayim banu ba'avanotenu v'avda chochmat chachamav. And it's been so bad that the wisdom of the wise has been lost. Vazlat yad haTorah v'lomdeh. And the power of the Torah and those who learn it has gone. Kilo nasera Torah kishtei Torot. Right, the Gemara often is afraid that the Torah will become like two Torot, and he says that's not the reality I see in front of me. Ela kitorot ein mispar. The Torah has become numerous, uncountable, right, innumerable. It's technically the number that, right, the word there, innumerable Torot, right? There is so much machloket. There are so many traditions, right? There are so many ways to rule, so many ways to paskin. Right? Ein mispar l'sivat rov asarim and sarim b'veyur mishpatei avedina. There are just so many books. V'gam ki heim aleihem ha-shalom kavanatam hayta la'ir machsha mechoshkenu nimshach lanu mitoch ha-or ha-tov shenu heim aleihem ha-shalom safeku mevocha rabba. And he said, here's the irony. All these wonderful svarim were written to clarify halacha, but the net result of having so many is that we are stuck in utter darkness. Right? This is his explanation of why he needs to write a book. Is simply, there is way too much halachic material out there, and nobody knows what to do with it. Okay?
So let's write another book.
Good. Right? That's always the solution. Right? He says, He said, everyone just writes, and they summarize what everyone else said. Or they contradict what people said before. They don't even mention who they're talking about. And for some reason, people were into this of just quoting things without names, right? Without attributions. So no one even knows who you're quoting, right? It's utter chaos, right? That's what he's describing. So he says, so go to the next paragraph. He says, "V'im yomar adam b'chol din shitzarech lachkor shosho motzo b'dvarim ha-gemara v'amafreshim v'poskim kulam." He said, if anyone has a halachic shaila, they say, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go from the Gemara, read all the early sources, and I'm going to make a decision. How's that going to go for you? Yichbar ha-davar alav ma'od. It is going to be hard. Right? That's the understatement of the century, or I guess millennium. Fine. And he said, if you want to do independent analysis and find it in the Gemara, good luck even finding where you're supposed to find it. Right? 2,711 pages of unorganized Talmud. Right? Good luck finding that halachic passage. There are books that try to tell you it, but when you read them, all that it convinces you is how little you know of the Talmud. Right? So the Beit Yosef is basically throwing his hands up in the air and saying, most people, if they try to paskin from the Gemara, good luck. If they try to paskin from reading previous sources, good luck. Right? And therefore, his job was, and he says, right, even if you know where it is in the Gemara, you're ahead of the game. Now you got to read everybody who wrote on that Gemara. So he says, there's Rashi, Tosfot, Rif, Rush, Ran, Mordechai, Rambam, Shara Poskim, Shuvot HaGdolim, ... Okay? Fine. Next paragraph. V'im bidin habal yad adam kach v'misha rotze le'dasher shekol dinim abor yam la'kif divrei kol cholkim behem cholkei divrei kol achad ve'achad mehem ala achad kama gama shivat ser menu. If you have halacha, now you want to know every opinion and everyone who disagreed. It's not happening. He said, best case scenario is you manage to learn one halacha all the way to the end. And by the time you get to the end, you have forgotten everything you've learned. Right? And definitely by the time you move to the next halacha, you've forgotten it. Right? So for all of you who, you know, sometimes feel disheartened by how much there is to learn, you're not the first. And you are not the last. So he says, well, maybe you look at summary books. He says, that's not going to work either, because the summary books don't give you the whole story. Okay? So, if you skip down, to the paragraph that says, Nimtza. Actually, you know what? No, go to the one who says Vizem Mishpat HaSefer. So now, this is the important thing, right? Now that he's explained the chaos, he explains why he wrote his book, how he wrote his book, and what he's doing in his book. Okay, so here you go. Snapshot, how did Shulchan Aruch become Shulchan Aruch? Okay? Vizem Mishpat HaSefer Umaseu. This is this book, and how I made it. V'vayer Adin Shekatav Balaturim. I want to explain the tour. Imu Mishnah, O Braita, O Tosefta, O Memra B'Talmud Bavli, O B'Yerushalmi, O B'Sifra, B'Sifrei, O B'Mechelta. First thing I do is, I'm going to take a law on the tour, and I'm going to explain to you. Is Is it from a Gemara, Bavli, Rishalmi, other Tanaitic sources, Amoraic sources? Right? Step one. Explain to you where this came from in the canon. Right? In the primary sources. Step one. Step two. The imhu muskam. If it is agreed upon within those canonical sources. Or if it's a dispute by Chaber and the Tur, in this case, the author, Pasak Echad Mehem. Ube'ezetam Pasak Moteh, why he ruled the way he did. Ve'emevi'a mechaber svarot postim cholkim bedinahu, yiva'er tam kol echad mesvarot shersham motzah betamud. And if he brings multiple positions, I will explain how each of the precedent, right? The previous authorities explained this, right? How each of the previous authorities understood the Talmud and got to their law. If he leaves somebody out, so yavi svara poskim anishmatim tamam, then I'll bring whoever he left out. Fine. V'im divrei izam poskim mahem bein shemim mechaber bein shemim mevim einam uvanim yavar divrei day izrahem. If you don't understand them, so then I'll explain it. Okay. And then he goes on, skip to the next paragraph. Nimtza shemisha yasefer ze lefanav yusturim lefanav divrei Talmud. So that means, if you have my book, you will have the Gemara in front of you. Im, Perush, with the commentaries of
Rashi,
Tosfot, Ran, Piskei Rif, Rosh, Mordechai, Rambam, Magotav, Magad Mishnah, Rav Eni Rucham, Sefer HaTrumah, Shmuel HaLeken, Harukeach, Sharei Dura, Sefer Tashbet, Sefer Itter, Mukai Yosef, Smag, Smag, Orchon Chaim, Torah, Bayit, Agor, Ashri, Sefer Amani, Ha'agor, Sefer Balei Nefesh, La'arai, V'chubit HaRash, V'arashba, V'aribar, Sheshet, Shimrat Semach, Mori Kolon, Shuman HaDeshen, V'kol Devarim, V'arim HaDev. You will have all that whole list of people explained to you, right? His point is, this is my list of basic 30 poskim you have to know. I've summarized every one of them for you. That's why I wrote this book, so you don't have to read them. Uvikzat mikomot mamare hazohar. And sometimes,
oh.
Zohar. Yes, this made it into Shulchan Aruch. I'm sorry. Vilichyot. So now he says, okay, so far what has he told you? What does he care about in Psak?
Looking at other authorities.
Right? The Gemara, and how previous authorities understood it. How does he make his decision? V'lechiot ki kvar noda, sharosh, v'amurachai, smag, v'smag, zivar, chumah, v'agot, maimon, kulam, nisharim, achrayadot, al arov. Since I know that all the Ashkenazi Rishonim basically are following the tradition of Tosfot, so, lochein, im b'ktad mekomot lochtov da'atam, if some of them is not right Tosfot, that's okay. I'm getting it from the Rush, that's fine. Next paragraph. How do I paskin? Lachain hiskamti bidati. I have made the decision. Kilichyot shloshet amudei ha'ora'a asher ha'bayit beit Yisrael nishan aleihem behoroteihem alohema harif ha'ramam v'harash sal v'zechonam levracha amarti alibisha b'makom sheshnai mehem maskimim lidar achat nifsok halacha kmotam imlo b'mektad mekomo shekol chachmei Yisrael o rubam cholken ala darahu v'lachain pashat ha'minhag behefech. What does he say? Normal circumstances I take best of three. Rif, Rambam, Rush. I take best of three. Unless most Chachamim follow a different tradition or the custom is different. So what did the Beis Yosef just tell you? The three factors he cares about in Psak are understanding the Gemara, getting precedent, and Minhag. Under most circumstances, which factor for the Beit Yosef, for Rabbi Yosef Karo, is the most important?
Analysis.
Nope.
I mean,
this, right? Not independent analysis. Under most circumstances, he tells you his general rule is, he takes three authorities and picks the best of three. Right? Now, you can ask why he picked those. That's not the point for the moment. He tells you that for the most part, he thinks that Psak works by taking the majority of precedent and interpreting the primary text only in light of the majority of previous authorities. So which of these does he give the most weight to? Under most circumstances, is previous authorities, right? But, now I want to make this point again. when I say the poskim do this, and it's a balancing act, and no one is 100% in any of these camps, right? These are the three factors, right? He cares about what the Gemara says independently. He cares about custom, and he tells you that sometimes what will happen? Sometimes the custom will win, despite the fact that usually precedent wins, right? Again, this is my point. Psak is not magic, right? It's not a science, as Rabbi Bleich says it. Psak is not a science, it's an art, right? There isn't predictive rules. He's not telling you always, always, always do this. He's saying most of the time, I think the best way to get to the truth is not my independent analysis and not custom, is precedent. But sometimes custom is so overwhelming that it'll overwhelm precedent, right? But primarily he's a precedent posek, right? Primarily, right? Again, always, no. He cares about these two factors as well. But which one is his go-to? Precedent, yeah.
My question is literally not, it's so tangential, it's like nothing connected to this.
Okay.
How on earth does he have the time to do all this?
He was superhuman. He was superhuman. I don't know. I feel inferior also when I read this. What can I do? Yes. Yes. I agree with you. And then in the next paragraph he says, and obviously things get a little bit more complicated if these three poskim, the Rush, the Riff, and the Rambam, don't talk about it, so then he has to rely on other authorities. Okay, fine. But fundamentally, model one of Psak is, I care about all three, but I give the most weight to how did previous authorities understand the Gemara, right? But my go-to is right here, right, in the middle. Good. Next source, Darkei Moshe, Rav Moshe Israelis, the Rambam. He says, just to skip to the... He says, I like the Beit Yosef, but I don't love the Beit Yosef for three reasons. Okay? So let's just look at his reasons. Look at Ha'alef, right, second paragraph, Ha'alef. So, Lahavi kol advarim la'ora ha'atza'ot, asher elu advarim heimal taminim kamoni l'l'od, rotzim lo maratural, regal achat, kim'at, sha'od l'chein bazeh zakti, b'rekayim koshloka, edumim divi ha'arav ha'maresh, gadav, sha'ore ha'atza'ot, hu min ha'sibot asher lomeid poslod. Said first is, Beit Yosef is too long, right? I'm going to summarize things sometimes because it's just too long. Okay, technicality, I don't love... The Beit Yosef, it's long. Fine. Hasheni, Shosafti, Aldvarav, Kama Vekama. Right, he said, look, sometimes I added books that he didn't quote, and he just says, because it, you know, as much as it's unfathomable what he wrote, he said, look, right, HaMechaber Beit Yosef Lorayu Miyaman, there are things that the Beit Yosef didn't see. It happened after him. He just didn't know about them. He didn't have access to them. Okay, fine. That's not the main point. Hashlishit hu ha'ikar. Right, third paragraph. Or fourth paragraph. Right, where he says, Hashlishit hu ha'ikar. Main reason he wrote the Darkei Moshe, even though the Beit Yosef already existed, is, hu tachlit ha'muvukash b'zeh ha'machkar, is that I don't really agree with the purpose of the Beit Yosef. Ki yadua, sha'arava mechaber Beit Yosef, b'tiv'o el ha'gadolim nichsaf. Right, the Beit Yosef, what does that mean? By nature, El HaGdolim Nichsaf, right? He was swept away with the G'dolim, right? The previous rabbis. He cares about authority. Upasak halacha b'chol makom opi shnei u'shlosha edim. And he would rule based on two or three out of three. Hema ha'gaonim ha'nechmadim ha'rif ha'ramam ha'arash b'chol makom sh'shnayim mehem ledar achat nismadim, and would rule like two out of three. U'l'shar rabvata adirei ha'torah lochash aleihem, and didn't care about what other people said. Rak b'makom gdolim amad levsok halacha k'divei shneihem. V'afim mehem kamai v'lo batrai v'lochash ledvarim sh'tzavchu bo kamai dekamai, and he didn't care about what other people yelled about it and screamed about, etc., etc. And based on this, he says, "V'halo ha'riv." Right? Shebasak so peregrinim niskimo imo rabim levzok alacha b'chol makom kibatrai. So the riff tells you should care about later authorities, v'lo lachos l'divrei kamai, not the earlier ones. I'm going to bracket that for a moment. V'afil b'makom ha'rav itzal tamid. Even if it's a student versus a teacher, v'chein basko achronim tamid, and that's how the achronim, the later authorities, rule. V'rosham. And now he says, "I don't like the authorities that the Beit Yosef chose." Sounds like precedent. Except, watch. He says, why don't I like them? Rosham maharik umahari, v'tshuvotein an imot. Especially, I like these later authorities. Asher Behen and Iru Kol Machshavos V'Gilu Kol Talamot, where they enlightened all darkness and revealed all secrets. Vayidei Hadavar Satar, because of the way the Beit Yosef paskind, Satar Kol HaMinhagim Asher Be'ilu HaAratzot. Because of his authority, the way he viewed authority, he went against
custom,
the way we practice halacha here in Ashkenaz. Right? So, the Darkei Moshe. Does he care about authority? He does. He does, right? He says the Beit Yosef ignored Ashkenazi authorities. But what does he really care about? Custom. Because he says, what I like is that the Ashkenazi authorities record custom. And the Beit Yosef's overemphasis on precedent
does not
erased the halachic conclusions that are reflected in practice. So therefore, what do you get? Right now you've... So like I said, you have... Right? He also cares about the Gemara. He also cares about precedent. Right? He tells you, I'm going to add sources. I'm going to explain the sources more succinctly. I'm going to quote people that he didn't quote. But his fundamental problem is that the Beis Yosef gave too much weight to authority, whereas, as he understands it, the Ashkenazi tradition gave more weight to custom. And the Beit Yosef, in his sort of mathematical obsession with two out of three, gave too much weight to precedent. Now, very quickly, what do both Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Zilis, have in common? They are both writing what? Codes. Because they both think that what? You should reach a consensus, either based on what people do, custom, or based on what previous people said. But they both, therefore, think a code is a good idea, because you can codify custom, you can codify, right, precedent. Which of these is harder to codify? This one, right? Why? Because every posek might understand it differently. And if it's about how you understand the Gemara, you may understand it differently than has been practiced or has been ruled upon. Therefore, the Yamshel Shlomo, Rosh Shlomo Luria, writing at the same time, goes crazy and says, I don't like this entire codification. And he first gives an ode to the Talmud and everything that happens there. He loves it. But just because we have 3 minutes, I'll get you to the Kiyer, he says. Look at the second paragraph. V'lachein omar ha-chacham, a wise person will say, me'achar she-divrei ha-chachamim ha-amitim kulam divrei elokim chayim. Since all the Torah is true, afilu b'machlokotam, even their disputes, kavachomer bashvatem yachad, for sure when they agree, imkein, hagabas mecha, Moshe, lama lo katam mipia gvura beheri tev kifisha roi. Why didn't just Moshe write everything clearly? Biblishi bo shum safek. So there'll be no doubt. V'yeh panim echad l'tara v'lo memtet. So there'll be only one and not 49 faces to the Torah. Just make everything clear. Gam zulet zamashe roi lo zuf l'gzor ra'uy l'moshe l'di b'sefer. And tell us everything that's going to be decreed. Said, why didn't you do that? So he says... And you skip down, because God wanted that, right? Right? God wanted it, right? God likes machlokes; He likes people to decide. And therefore, He says, you know, I'll say this. I have 2 minutes. Okay, I'm going to summarize this outside, right? Basically, He says the following. He says, look at the paragraphs. Emet Sheri Moshe Ben Maimon. Right? He said, the Rambam wrote a code. Asachi burnam mikol asher yu lefanav. Binyan zeh asher yu misudar v'chol tabrukah v'chol tzer sifur v'chol kol derab zerab. It has the whole Torah. It's clear. It's easy. But, u'v'emet lefi da'ato v'sechol kadav kol tera ilu kivel Moshe mipi ha'gvura halach al Moshe Sinai. In a little bit of biting irony, he said he wrote the Torah so clearly with such conviction as if he were Moshe Rabbeinu and not Moshe ben Maimon. Right, he thinks he got it from God. Right? He said, I don't like this very much. Right? Mibli ra'aya. He just quotes it as if he's right and proves nothing. Right? He says, I don't really like codes, including the Rambam. I don't like this notion. Because God likes machloket, He likes dispute, and therefore, I don't like this notion that there's one answer. What are we going to do instead? Next paragraph. Nachzor l'rishonot. What's my methodology? Go back to basics. Lihat Talmud. Asher anu oskimbo v'nimnu umimenu anu shotim. Let's go back to the Talmud, which we drink from. He said, "Who are the commentaries I really like? Lulei chachmei atzarfatim balei atosvot. I like Tosvot. Because what is Tosvot's job in the Gemara? Not to rule. What do?
Explain
and they bring all these seemingly contradictory passages in Talmud into conversation. So he says, Lulei chachmei atzarfatim balei atosvot chasu otoki gadur echad. Right, I would be lost if it weren't for the balei atosvot who took the entire Gemara and made it into one big ball. Right? They took these disparate passages and put it all together. And about them, right? It's them who I love. They are the ones who are the wise ones. So what does he do? He says, I disagree with the entire notion of codification because that gives too much emphasis to custom and to precedent. And I think the ambiguity is intentional. And what you have to do whenever you paskin is, go back and understand it yourself. You can use authority to understand it. You can use custom to figure it out. But at the end of the day, you are beholden to how you understand these sources. Now again, each of these three major poskim have different factors. They all care about all three factors, right? They all quote people. They all recognize custom. They all go through the Gemara. But they question which has the most weight. And you get three models. Those who care the most, again, not exclusively, about independent understanding of the primary sources, like the Amtur Shlomo, people who care most about what previous poskim have said, barring cases where you're overwhelmed either by a different understanding of Gemara or by custom, right? Beit Yosef, Yosef Karo, and people who say our first line of right attack is, what do people do? Again, that doesn't mean it's always right, but that's the one we give the most weight to. And this is what I'm saying, that Psak is not a science, it's an art. Everyone agrees on the factors. But what Psak practically needs, every posek has to weigh for themselves, which of these factors are you going to give the most weight to? And the last thing I'll leave you with is that for many, many, many years, since Shulchan Aruch, these two were the most dominant until really the Gra, right? The yeshiva tradition that emerged in Vilna after the Gra, right? And his writing and his students, etc., brought this very much back into conversation, right? Because the Gra would paskin based on how he understood the Gemara, and then major books like, I would argue, parts of the Mishnah Berurah, especially the Be'er Halacha, where he sometimes goes back to the Gemara, though not always. He is more of a precedent posek. The Aruch HaShulchan more, who cares about custom and independent analysis, reflects a combination of traditions. The Chazon Ish, who on principle doesn't write by Sif and Shulchan Aruch, writes by topic, right, so that he can go from the Gemara, right? This re-emerges, right, in the last 200 years as yeshivot developed. And then this is what we'll end with. When it comes to, as I said, contemporary halachic issues, even if you are generally a precedent or a custom posek, right, this becomes a lot more important because often you don't have much to work with, right? And therefore, the poskim that are of this tradition have the best shot, right, at dealing with these issues. Right, if you usually rely on precedent or custom, often you're going to have trouble when it comes to contemporary issues. Okay, so with this sort of snapshot of the art of Psak and the unique complexities that modern halachic issues deal with, like I said, I am happy. I'll just say this: I'm happy at different points of the year to take shiurim when you feel it's necessary and focus just on the broader methodological issues, but. Since this is contemporary halacha, we will mostly go through actual cases, but always with an eye towards methodology, helping you understand what is this process and understand how decisions have been made and how decisions will be made, which I think will help you make the halachic process feel like it's your own, right? Which is really my goal for the year, okay? Okay, we good?